David Foster Wallace, who's best known for his 1,097-page magnum opus, Infinite Jest, committed suicide 4 years ago when he was just 46 years old. He's the subject of Every Story is a Ghost Story, an exhaustively researched new biography by the New Yorker staff writer D.T. Max. It explores everything from Wallace's early life and artistic philosophies to his many relationships and ongoing battles with substance abuse and depression. The New York Times Review called it a page-turner. D.T. Max was on our show in January, and listeners told us how much they enjoyed the conversation, so we thought we would re-air it for you today. I began by asking, why is Wallace considered by many to be one of the most influential writers of his generation? Do we see it reflected in books that are being published now?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's a couple of reasons why. One is just the brilliance of what he wrote, but it's also because he's had so many offspring. I mean, when you look at, you can look at a lot of recent writers from Dave Edgars to, you know, some perhaps lesser known writers, and you can just see a whole style, a whole way of looking at the world that really began with David. It's actually so familiar now, I don't think we realize how new it was when he, when he first sort of published Infinite Jest in 1996. It's a way of kind of opening yourself up to the world and opening yourself up to the language. It just hadn't happened before.
And he's very close to Jonathan Franzen. Was there some kind of an intellectual exchange between the two?
You know, there's a letter that John gave me from David where he describes them as best of friends and lit combatants, which I think pretty well captures it.
Well, Wallace is often called a maximalist writer. Is that a fair description of his writing approach?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, David was a guy who, you know, looked at the muchness of the world, at the totality of the world, and asked himself over and over, how can I possibly squeeze this, you know, onto the written page? Like, there's just so much out there, so much for me to think about, so much bombarding me in any given moment. So whereas for a lot of people, you know, you think, oh, David Foster Wallace, he stuffed everything he could think of into these books. I think actually the opposite is more true, which is he kept everything he could think of out of the books.
Well, do we learn much about his life? For example, the character Avril Incandenza, many people say he was based on his mother, a domineering woman.
You know, I mean, there's certainly aspects of David's mother in Avril Incandenza in Infinite Jest. My favorite is that Avril Incandenza is a member of something that's called the Militant Grammarians of Massachusetts, a sort of mythical organization. And it's true that David's mother, Sally, used to go into supermarkets, and if she would see, you know, she was an English professor, but she would go into supermarkets, and she saw the sign over the checkout, over the quick checkout line, 10 items or less, she would go to the manager and correct it to 10 items or fewer. I mean, there's lots of aspects of his family, but David was not primarily an autobiographical writer, and one of the challenges of Every Love Story is a Ghost Story was really that he wasn't an autobiographical writer. I mean, he barely wrote any memoir. You've got to, you know, it's always fraught, a favorite David Foster Wallace, where it's always fraught to look for evidence of a writer's life and his fiction. But to some extent, that's where you have to go with David.
Now, what about his influences? He could have gone in the direction of somebody like John Updike, but he seems to have decided that Thomas Pynchon, Donald Barthelme were the right influences for him. And on our show, he cited all sorts of other interesting people. Cynthia Ozick,
yeah. There's a letter I have. I had a lot of letters for the book, and there's one letter in which he writes, I forget to who, maybe it may be Don DeLillo, and he says, I bow to no other U.S. goy in my admiration for C. Ozick. Cynthia Ozick I can kind of unravel, but I think the more obvious influences are writers like Thomas Pynchon, David begins as a philosophy student, and he always has a highly technical mind. In fact, one of the first groups of readers to love David were really technical people, IT people. And so David really, in his first novel, a book I absolutely love called Broom of the System, reverse engineers a Thomas Pynchon novel and then puts it back together, a little bit different when he puts it back together. But still, you can see everywhere, you know, the evidence of the crying of Lot 49, so much so that there's in a conversation he had with a friend, the friend said to him, you know, well, I can see you had a lot of this came out of Crying of Lot 49. He said he'd never read the book.
You mentioned philosophers Ludwig Wittgenstein, Jacques Derrida, strong influences. But also, you suggest a lot of popular television shows.
That's right. I mean, one of the things that was really engrossing about David, and I think one of the most distinctive sort of marks that he leaves on the culture is this kind of joining together of high culture and low culture. And I think for some people that's a style of writing, but for David it was really the only way he could see the world. He used to say that the only thing, you know, he had addiction issues with alcohol and marijuana, but he used to say his one true addiction was to television. And in fact, his sister, you know, whom I talked to extensively for the book, said that she never in her life saw anyone watch TV as much as her brother did.
You mentioned his first book, The Broom of the System. Well, first of all, what kind of TV did he watch?
You know, he's a child of the 70s, and it's hard for people to remember, but, you know, David Foster Wallace didn't really have a lot of choices. I mean, he's sitting there in Champaign, Urbana, and I think they had five stations. I don't know. It was like, I mean, he and I are almost exactly the same age, or we would be. And, you know, I mean, I grew up in New York, and we only had five or six stations, and then there were those ghostly, you know, UHF stations. This is all forgotten. But so David watched, you know, he watched Batman, you know, he watched Alias, Smith and Jones. I mean, he watched what was on. I mean, he wasn't picky. That was sort of the point. And that's, I think, in a lot of ways why he rebelled so aggressively against media-saturated culture later. I mean, he wasn't a PBS guy.
You said that his first published work, The Broom of the System, was brilliant. First of all, what does the title mean?
Broom of the System, it's a funny story. You know, he wrote the book, by the way, as an undergraduate. We should point out that he's at Amherst, and he's only just become a writer. And one of the things I found most extraordinary about David Foster Wallace was the short period of time that it took him to become a really, really good writer. He's not really writing at all when he's a sophomore in college at Amherst. He has two breakdowns, and he comes back realizing, I think, that, I mean, as he would tell friends, like, you know, nobody's going to vote for someone who's been in the nut house. He'd actually wanted to be a politician beforehand. He had this idea he would be a congressman from Illinois. An amazing thought. David Foster Wallace, you know, in the house. Can you imagine? So, you know, he basically comes back.
Gives the Tea Party a whole new meaning.
He comes back, and what he does is, you know, he just writes. I mean, you know, there's a kind of bipolar quality to David's life, obviously. And he comes back and he writes this manuscript in the matter of a semester. So he's looking for a title for it. And Broom of the System is, you know, sort of has two meanings. One, in Wittgenstein, there's which is, you know, Wittgenstein's all about language, and there's the question about, like, which end of the broom is more important. You know, is it the end you sweep with, which is what most of us would say, or is it the other end, the end you hold? And, you know, and the point to be made is it depends what you want to do with the broom. If you want to break a window, well, then you need the end, you know, the wooden end. At the same time, his mother, Sally, who came from, you know, kind of rural background, her grandmother, I believe, used to say that you know, in order to clear out the system, you know, you should, in order to clean out the system, you should have an apple. And she described it as the broom of the system. It's irresistible. I mean, terrific. One of those donnés that, you know, writers just sometimes get.
My guest is D.T. Max. He's written a biography of David Foster Wallace called Every Love Story is a Ghost Story. So what about that title? He quoted that line a lot.
Yeah, Every Love Story is a Ghost Story is a phrase that has bedeviled my post-publication life, because I didn't actually know where it came from beyond that David had written it at the bottom of a couple of letters. And it appears in his notebooks throughout his life. And what I loved about the phrase from that point of view was, you know, it's not really a very David Foster Wallace kind of phrase. It's more something you'd imagine from, I don't know. I mean, it's just something that sticks in your head.
Well, he said Virginia Woolf.
Yes. Oh, yeah, right. So in these letters, he's still having kind of postmodernist fun, which was the style that he was writing in college and graduate school. And so he attributes it in these letters to Virginia Woolf. One time he attributes it to Virginia Woolf on the Merv Griffin show, speaking of the old days of five TV stations, and another time Virginia Woolf on the Johnny Carson show. So, I mean, it was just a game for him, but it sticks around right through his journals right up until his death.
Well, do you think the ghost may have also been the depression that haunted him? When did he first start to battle with serious depression?
You know, the depression, one thing I learned, which I had not known before, I had some of David's, you know, sort of self-diagnoses records, not really medical records, but records where he writes about his own experience. And he says in these records something that I had not realized, which is that he first experiences severe anxiety and phobias, you know, when he's 10 or 11. And they blossom into a real full-blown anxiety by the time he's in high school. David Foster Wallace is so anxious that he, you know, he was a great tennis player. Many things about David that I thought were true, I learned in writing the book, weren't true. But it is true that David was a really exceptional tennis player.
And tennis is a major theme.
Right. But, I mean, he wouldn't have been the first author to invent a full-blown, you know, professional career if he didn't have one. But he didn't have professional, but he was a really, really good Midwestern, you know, high school player, good, though. So he, you know, basically he would go around his high school, Urbana High, with a towel and a tennis racket in order to hide the fact that he was experiencing, you know, basically sweating from anxiety, from an anxious condition. And then by college, he has full-blown depression. I don't know if whether every love story is a ghost story. My feeling about that title for him is that it was a kind of a gloss on the fictional act. Like, you know, you're always trying, you're always falling in love, but the book is always, or the story is always just sort of getting away from you.
Didn't he have problems getting published? Girl with Curious Hair, which many people consider a breakthrough. And one critic said, with it, Wallace didn't announce the advent of a new media-saturated age, but was in it.
That must be Sven Burkert.
Was it?
Yeah, it's a terrific critic of David's work.
It's interesting, by the way, that Michiko Kakutani didn't like Infinite Jest, but she called this book one of the 10 best of the year. So
yeah,
maybe she's changed her mind, or maybe she likes the biography better than the novel itself.
I don't even know. I mean, a number of people have warmed to David's writing. You know, it's we always think critics are immortal and should be perfect. But actually, I mean, there's a learning curve when you have a writer as complicated as David. And that may be what went on.
I spoke with David Foster Wallace in 1996, and I'd like to play a little clip where in the conversation we spoke about his commitment to perfectionism.
Perfectionism is very dangerous because, of course, if your fidelity to perfectionism is too high, you never do anything, because doing anything results, it's actually kind of tragic, because it means you sacrifice how gorgeous and perfect it is in your head for what it really is.
Mm-hmm.
And there were a couple of years, I think, where I really struggled with that. You know, the book is imperfect, but I also know that the book is exactly the best I could have done for the 3 years that I was working on it.
Did his publisher want him to edit the book down a bit?
You know, it's just heartbreaking to hear that comment, because, you know, what follows for David after Infinite Jest is exactly the kind of manacles of perfectionism that never allow him to, you know, release his final novel, The Pale King. Yeah, I mean, he went, you know, David was funny. He went through a very kind of almost festive process of with Infinite Jest, with his very capable editor Michael Peach at Little Brown, where Michael would suggest stuff, David would take half of it. This is about cutting the manuscript, and Michael would never adduce literary reasons. It was always, you know, we're going to have to cut this so that we can keep the price point at $30. And actually, I think Michael was very smart, because I think if he had suggested that there were literary reasons why the book had to be shorter, David would have gotten his hackles up. He knew David Foster Wallace. He had this intuition that the way to deal with him was to almost be like a traveling salesman trying to sell him something, and then David would feel entire. But yeah, they cut it way down. Not as much as – there are a number of interviews where David says, you know, this book was cut by 500 pages. This book was cut by 700 pages. No, it wasn't. It was probably cut by about 100, and he may have stuffed some of it back in.
We have very little time, but I was wondering how much his passion for Mary Carr, the author of Liar's Club, who rejected him, motivated him to write Infinite Jest.
You know, I mean, I think it would be more convenient for all of us, because the relationship was such a train wreck, if Mary hadn't played a big role for him. But, you know, there's a note that I saw in the Ransom Center archives where David's stuff is, which says, you know, Mary Carr IJ was just a means to her end, as it were. Right.
Well, he had all sorts of substance abuse problems.
Right.
He took antidepressants. Didn't he also have ECT?
He did. He had it twice, once successfully, and once at the very end of his life, you know, not successfully. Twice that I know of. You know, I mean, David was a guy who had a rough life. I don't think there's any way to sugarcoat it. But there's also, I mean, an enormous amount of glory and pleasure in his life.
Did he leave a suicide note?
He did leave a suicide note, yeah. A stranger story is he tried to commit suicide several months before, and he mailed the suicide note to his wife, was found alive, and then she gets this suicide note in the mail, which I just think is, you know, there he was next to her already. It was one of those awful moments not even David Foster Wallace could have concocted for a story.
The book, Every Love Story is a Ghost Story, A Life of David Foster Wallace, is published by Viking. And I thank you so much for being on our show today.
Thank you for having me.